alternative to snoozing for the next few minutes, I'm going to talk. So that'll kind of help you stay awake and get some energy. I just wanted to put the teachings that we're doing here, the teachings and practice that we're doing here, into another, just a different perspective. You know, when the first generation of students in Asia first returned to the States and England, and maybe Canada too, I don't know, but there was a interest among students to hear what they had to offer, and the question was, well, what are we going to offer? What we were mostly interested in was the meditation. But the meditation is just one part of the teachings of the Buddha. It's a significant part, it's an essential part, but it's not the only part. And so the determination was made then that among the senior teachers that they wouldn't just teach the meditation, they would teach the Dharma, which is the whole of the Buddha's teaching. And so the Buddha said to establish your life in the Dharma, meaning the truth, the way things are, to walk this path of awakening, to really be stable in that, there are three foundations for stabilizing the mind and stabilizing your life. And the three foundations are three trainings or three practices of dana, or generosity, sila, living ethically in harmony with within and with others, and then bhavana, which is the development of the mind that includes both samatha, or tranquility practices, and insight or vipassana practice. So the decision of the senior teachers then was that they would not teach only the meditation, but in fact they would teach dana, sila, bhavana. And as a student at Meditation Center in Massachusetts when it first opened in 76, and as a teacher who'd been teaching there for 20, 25 years or so, it is incumbent on me to teach. I heard then, practice then, and it's incumbent on me to teach the three pillars, to teach dana, generosity, to teach sila, living ethically, and to teach bhavana. And all teachers that go to IMS in Massachusetts have to commit to doing that. So I've made it a practice of talking about the larger context, or the context in which to understand your meditation practice that we're doing here for the most part this weekend. And you can see from our practice here that, you know, what we have to learn to do is let go. We have to learn to let go of entanglement, obsessions, beliefs, assumptions. We have to learn to let go of everything, in part because, well, everything is impermanent anyway. And to live in alignment with the way things are, holding on is just, as they say, it just causes rope burn. So the practice of generosity is a way of letting go. The practice of sila is a way of letting go. The practice of samadhi is a way of letting go. And the practice of vipassana is a way of letting go. But then when the Buddha was teaching, was asked to share the Dharma or teach the Dharma, he always started with talking about the practice of generosity, which is not a Buddhist only a practice. It's like people all over the world, every culture, every tribe, every ethnic group values generosity, can only survive with the kind of heart and mind that is willing to share or able to share. And recognizing that as one of the foundations of our life, the Buddha put it first and foremost as the practice that all beings could understand. And in fact, you know, when we think about being generous, or when we consider what generosity is, you know, it's like offering a gift to somebody, and that's being generous. And we think of it as, well, I'm giving something to the other person, rather than understanding it from, and that's the external, you know, that's the externalized view of what's happening. The internalized view of it is, I'm practicing letting go. And it's not just letting go of the gift, a book or time or knowledge or experience or whatever, but it's letting go of attachment to the things that we think we own and have and are and have become. And so generosity is the first hurdle, I guess you'd say, of dealing with attachment, our identification with stuff, things, ourself, our time, our knowledge, our energy, our love. And as we know, being generous is not easy. So we can see, if it's that hard for just practicing in a kind of a non-denominational, kind of generic, good, wholesome human being way, then further letting go, more refined letting go, subtler letting go of our heart, mind, is going to be also equally challenging. So the Buddha talked about the benefits of generosity, encouraging people to practice generosity, and also acknowledging the limitations of generosity. But when we see that the practice that we've been doing here is about learning how to let go, then generosity is a good supplemental foundation practice for the mind learning how to let go, period, and then let go of identification with ownership of all kinds of things. And when the Buddha was living, at the time of the Buddha, it was a cultural norm for monks, men and women, others, monks, to become monks, nuns, ascetics, wanderers, sadhus, of one sort or another, because there was a great interest in understanding the spiritual life and living the spiritual life. And the culture and society supported, you know, it was built in to support renunciates in that way. And then when, you know, the teachings of the Buddha were known and others inquired about the teachings, you know, of different monks and nuns, the Buddha said, you can share what you know. You know, you can share the teachings with anyone who's sincerely interested. But one of the requirements of monks and nuns is that they have to be, or they are supported by people. And while their four requisites of the clothes, their monastery, place to stay, their medicine and food are pretty minimal, nevertheless, they have to have robes, they have to have a place to stay, they have to have medicine when sick, and on a daily basis, they have to have food. And so while monks and nuns could accept an invitation to go wherever they were invited to teach, to share, they could only stay if they were supported on a daily basis with daily food, because monks and nuns can't keep food overnight, they can't run a garden, they don't handle money to buy food, and so they're reliant on a daily support of students, those who are interested in supporting monks and nuns. That tradition has carried the teachings of the Buddha to us over 2,500 years. And so far as we know, really the teachings of the Buddha have not been bought or sold, have not been for sale. Of course, there's books and there's courses and there's stuff like this that, you know, cost money, but the teachings, free, available. My being here, freely offering the teachings, the Vims, who invited me at your request, sponsors my getting here and taking care of me and sending me back. But the funds that you pay to come to do the retreat or whatever you want is just gifts to support the organization and gifts to support me if you wish. It's really, it's nice to be able to do that. It's nice to be able to say, I have received these teachings over 45 years, and I've had the opportunity to practice with great teachers, really skillful guidance, and it never, no one ever asked me to pay for it. And now I feel this, I understand the power of that, because now that I have the opportunity to share what I've learned and practiced and what I know, I see that, you know, some of what I know or practice is easy for me to say and for you to hear. Some of what I know about the journey of awakening is not easy to share, and it's not easy to hear, like dukkha, you know. And so it's easy to kind of want to offer just the good parts of the Dharma, you know, the joy, the bliss, tranquility, peace, you know, living in harmony. But then you get the dukkha part. And, you know, if we had to commodify, and there is some, I must say, there's some commodification of the Dharma undergoing these days, secularization and commodification. And, you know, if you package up a piece of the Dharma into, here's a package of loving kindness, would you like to buy some loving kindness? You know, whether it's a course or a retreat or whatever, a book, it's like, yeah, okay, great. And it can be sold that way. Or joy. Joy is another one. People like joy. There's a tremendous amount of depression in our culture, so it's good that joy is available. And it gets commodified into a package of, here's a book, here's a thing, here's a course, available for money. Okay, it's available. Our culture is, you know, it's a capitalist exchange culture, and that's to be expected, and there's no judgment of that. Except that not everybody can afford it. Okay, most places and teachers would also make those available. But imagine, okay, dukkha. I got a little package of dukkha here, and it's all about dukkha. It's all about suffering. And you know, would you like to buy some? No. Nobody wants to buy a book on dukkha. Nobody wants to buy a course on dukkha. It's not like, it's like, okay, so in some ways, because I'm not being paid, I can say what I like. I can offer you dukkha, all the dukkha, all the dukkha you don't want. It kind of, in some ways, not having to sell it, not having to commodify it or sell it or wrap it up in a nice package for sale, ensures that I can share the fullness of the Buddhist teaching. And you don't have to feel like you're getting a bum deal. You're getting, you know, I didn't order this, you know, as Ajahn Brahm from Perth says, who ordered this truckload of dung? You know, this dukkha, you know. Well, here we are. It's available. And so in some ways, it preserves the integrity of the teachings that you don't pay for it. You don't pay for it, you can get it straight. You know, in some ways, it really allows the teacher the freedom to not package it in a palatable, beautiful wrapper of whatever spiritual goodies you want to talk about, but to say, you know, this is the Dharma. This is the fuller or the more complete version of the Buddhist teaching. So I feel that's really an insurance and a protection. It's a support for our generation to really ground the fullness of the Buddhist teachings in the West. We're still in the first generation of, you know, Dharma-interested folks here in the West. It's only been 40, 45 years, 50 years. So we're just starting. And if we toss out the difficult stuff now, who's going to bring it back in another 10, 15, 20, 50, 100 years? So we need to plant it in the soil of our hearts and our understanding of practice now in this first generation. So I think that offering the Dharma, as Vims does, offering this opportunity freely, my offering teachings freely, helps ensure that we have the authentic Dharma and the full Dharma available to us now and in the future. That being said, I can only do what I do because, well, I have been supported by students like yourself who hear, practice, appreciate, realize something, want to support it happening, or want to support me to be able to do this, and I appreciate that. I don't demand or expect very much, and there's no one-to-one expectation that, you know, you're going to offer this much, you should offer this much, or anything like that. You know, there is an understanding, because it's, well, it's historically established now over 40 years that, well, students do support teachers. So I can't say there's no expectation. There's expectation, I know. I mean, I'm aware that historically, now for 25 years, you know, students have been very supportive, very generous in supporting me to be able to do what I do. And I just want to take the opportunity to thank you now. Some of you may have made donations in the back of the room for my support and teaching, and I want to thank you. It's a wonderful opportunity to get together and share the Dharma. And some of you have been supporters of my teaching for decades already. Thank you. I'm not suffering. I don't wear rags. I'm not losing weight. My car still works well. So evidently it's good enough. I can't retire, but nevertheless, I can get tired sharing the Dharma. I can't retire, though. So it's important that we understand our relationship around the Dharma, because I'm not offering you the Dharma in exchange for your gifts. I'm offering you the Dharma out of my own sense of generosity. I feel this is a beautiful thing, and I feel very supportive of you who want to hear the Dharma. I feel generous in just giving you the teachings, my experience, my time, to just, and do with it what you will. No expectation. It's not a quid pro quo. It's not an exchange. It's not a barter. It's not a trade, and it's not payment. But if you want to practice your generosity, and you want to express your gratitude through practicing generosity to support me to do what I do, that's your practice. That ennobles your heart. It allows me to do my work, and I appreciate that. But from the interior perspective, you're ennobling your heart. The Buddha said there are like 8 or 9 different motivations for practicing generosity. You know, to be, out of pride, out of getting something for yourself, out of expectation, out of being a tradition, out of anger even. Sometimes we give gifts out of anger. And, you know, he lists all these things, the last of which is to ennoble your own heart, to really beautify your own heart. We offer gifts. And so when we understand that, then we understand, oh, you know, there's no expectation that you're going to want to beautify your own heart. You might. That's good. When I receive gifts of support from you, it's not pay. I don't consider it pay. The government considers it pay. I have to pay taxes, but I don't consider it pay. I understand it's your gift of out of gratitude. And in some ways, I hold it as, I kind of understand it as your investment in ensuring that you have the Dharma available in your life now and in the future. Because to support VIMS to hold retreats like this, to support me to be able to teach, ensures that there will be the opportunities in the future to hear the Dharma, practice the Dharma, realize the Dharma. And so when I receive gifts of support, that's how I think of it. That's how I use it. Some of it's to support me. Some of it's to support in the development of a small sanctuary hermitage, Dharma sanctuary hermitage on Maui, and to support the printing of books by Utejaniya for free distribution, to train younger students who show promise as potential teachers, to train them, to support our teachers in Burma, Utejaniya. I see him every year and offer support. To bring him to the States. And by the way, I don't know when Saito is coming to the West next. I'll be inquiring in November when I see him. But the last time he was here in 2015, he was in Seattle. Someone from Nanaimo came to see him in Seattle, and we were having a conversation, and they said, "Saito, why don't you come to Canada next time?" He said, "Okay, I will." So I hope you're prepared when I get the word that he's coming to the West, that you can kind of organize a retreat for him up here, okay? Just to drop that in your little pre-planning bucket here. It'd be great, because there's a lot of people that have heard of his teachings, and the last time that he tried to get to Canada, they wouldn't give him a visa, but I think maybe we can work it out next time. Who knows? We'll see if he comes again or when he comes. So I use the funds that I get for just supporting Dharma activities, other teachers, centers, scholarship funds, particularly for young adults and for people of color, training of other teachers, junior teachers, printing books, just whatever seems like it would be useful for helping us all to have access to the Dharma now and in the future. That's how I really use it. So I wanted to share a little bit about the practice of letting go through generosity. Then Sila, the second of the foundations, is really practicing right speech, right actions, or I should say careful speech, careful actions, so that we don't act out strategies that cause harm. And traditionally it's around five areas of behavior or misbehavior: killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, speaking, and use of intoxicants. Now, I don't know about you, but you know, when you read the news each day, or you go on your news aggregator online, or whatever it is, wherever you read the news, it is a catalog of suffering committed yesterday by people who don't keep the precepts. That's the news. And it's just a tremendous amount of suffering because of shamelessness in killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, deception, not speaking the truth, and the use of intoxicants. I mean, these five areas of our life are just the playground of torment for ourselves and for others. And you don't have to get moralistic about it. You can just see, if you're careless, you suffer. Not only the perpetrators suffer, but certainly the victims suffer. And, you know, we've all been on both ends of the stick at different times. So we can see. You don't have to look too far. You know, when the personal history review comes up, when you're doing your meditation and the personal history review comes up, what comes up? Times when you haven't been keeping the precepts. You know, when you've caused pain or pain has been caused to you by others not keeping the precepts. And it's just a tremendous amount of suffering that, you know, the Buddha said, to really establish your life in the Dharma, to really want to wake up, you know, we want to wake up to lessen pain. And if we keep acting out in a way that causes pain, we're not going to wake up. You know, we're just going to fall back asleep because the pain is too unbearable. Kind of obvious, and yet it's not easy. As the Buddha said, it's not easy to do that which is really good for you. It's not easy. It's easy to do that which isn't very good for you, but it's very difficult to do that which is really good for you. And, you know, you don't have to hear a moralistic rant from me. I'm not a fundamentalist Buddhist or a fundamentalist anything. I'm just kind of a practical, you know, and I see it's not easy. You know, we live in a culture that condones, accepts, rewards deception, and the use of intoxicants. Values it, rewards it. How can we live in this culture that might give lip service otherwise, but actually condones such harm? How can we live in the culture and not be affected by it? who among us can stand in moralistic, you know, righteousness and say, when, well, we're complicit, if not acting it out ourselves. So, you know, while the social norms, social mores, cultural understandings may permit us certain behavior, beliefs, assumptions, why not? Freedom doesn't. To really liberate the mind is going to take more than cultural okayness. Again, it's going against the stream, going against the stream of our conditioning. Even though it's high-minded and well-intended, it isn't valued and honored. We have to do that within ourselves and within our own communities, within our own relationships. We have to make that kind of commitment, keep that kind of commitment, so that we support our own awakening and the awakening of others that we share the path of awakening with. And then, so we learn to let go. We learn to let go of our self-indulgent habits. We learn to let go of our righteousness. We learn to let go of our, you know, impatience with ourselves and others. We learn to let go of, you know, carelessness. Not easy, right? We know. I know I'm preaching to the choir, but nevertheless, it's just a good reminder. It's not easy. And then the development of the mind, the bhavana, the third foundation of the Dharma in your life, is all about letting go. It's learning to remember to recognize the present moment rather than forget, which is what we do. That's our habit. It's just not pay attention, to live in denial, avoidance, minimizing, deception, delusion. And we're used to it. We're like a fish in water, in living in a deluded state, in the deluded, you know, habits of mind. And so to learn to let go of that takes tremendous amount of aspiration, clarity, interest, energy, continuity, support from one another. And even then it's difficult. As the Buddha said, it's easy to do that which is of no benefit to yourself. It's very difficult to do that which is really beneficial to yourself. And we see, you know, it's not easy. We're here yesterday and today doing what we do, and it's great to have the support. And even though it seems we can all feel well intended to, yeah, this is valuable, I'd like to do this, I'd like to do more of this, may it go well. You know, it's not easy, you know. So get the support you need from teachers and community and others and books or whatever it is that you need to support your own aspiration. You know, this is a do-it-yourself job. You know, the teachings are available. The Buddha did his work, and he offered the teachings. Now we have to do our work. You know, there's no poof magic. Sprinkle the stardust on you, and you got it. It doesn't work that way. So you hear the teachings, you do the practice, slowly we can grow in understanding, liberation, letting go. Yeah. Any questions about that? Just as a little dharmet. Yeah. Do you breathe?
Sometimes.
Wherever you go, your mind is there. No matter how fast you go, your mind is there. If you train in recognizing the mind, if you train in recognizing your attitude, you can develop awareness and liberation in your daily life. Yes, intensive periods of time like this or on retreat, it helps, it supports, it encourages, you know, but it's your mind you're working with. If you have the aspiration to really see your mind and you pay attention to your mind, you pay attention to your intentions, your aspiration, your attitudes of mind, nobody can stop you. The thing is, once you get that flame lit within your own heart, nobody can put it out except you yourself. That's why Sayadaw Tejaniya teaches the way he does. That's why I teach the way I do, so that lay people, householders like ourselves, and we have busy lives, we all do. Even if you're retired, you have a busy life, you know? So it seems like I don't have time. We have just as many hours in the day as a monk does, or none. Right? So if we have that aspiration and we have that understanding, we have that instruction, we can do the work. It does take reprioritizing stuff in your life, of course. You know, if you keep the priorities of distraction and entanglement high in your life as a high priority, then you can expect to take longer. But it is possible to wake up. You know, it is. Deepama was a householder. She was a grandma. So, even grandmothers, no problem. Grandfathers, maybe. Maybe a problem. I'm just being hilarious. That's because I know, because I'm a grandfather. It's like, oh, it's hard work. So, other comments, questions? So let's sit for a bit.